City. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. First case of the morning will be Fifth Third Bank versus CXF Corporation. Are you Mr. Allen? Okay, you can proceed.
May it please the court, Kenneth Allen for Fifth Third Bank and the Bouchards. Cheryl was brain injured. Her daughter was killed at the grade crossing when an Amtrak train hit their minivan at County Road 400 East in Newton County, Indiana. The district court, to which this case was removed from state court, granted summary judgment on the issue of federal preemption. But to cloak themselves with the mantle of preemption and enshroud themselves with the immunity from state tort liability that doctrine invokes, the defendants bear a very onerous burden. They need to prove four things: that federal funds participated in the upgrade of this crossing, in the installation, three, of approved warning devices, four, which were operating and fully functional at the time. Participation of federal funds is not an issue in this case, but the three other prerequisites to preemption certainly are. The evidence before the district court established six important points for this court's consideration. One is that in 1975...
How is this case any different from that Shanklin?
Oh, it's okay.
How do you get out from under that case?
Well, Shanklin said, and I believe the Seventh Circuit has said time and again, particularly in Thiel, that not only must federal funds participate, but the protection has to be installed and operating. That's clear as day. In Shanklin, there was no dispute that the protection was installed and operating. The question was whether it was participation of federal funds. So that I think, is the key distinction here. This issue really has not been before this circuit, or the Supreme Court, for that matter, yet. But the evidence showed that there was a federal upgrade project pursuant to an agreement that was entered into in 1975 with regard to this crossing at 400 East. Two, that the crossbucks were to be fully compliant with the MUCTD. That's part of Shanklin, part of the regulation 646.214B1 that Shanklin was based upon, and part of the agreement that the railroads entered into with the state. Three, to be compliant, one high-intensity reflectorized crossbuck had to face each approach to the crossing. Four, an engineering study had found restricted sight lines on this road for motorists approaching us from the south. And to be compliant under those circumstances, under the MUCTD, there had to be two reflectorized crossbucks facing the motorists from that direction. So the next fact is that by all accounts, there was one crossbuck that was extant at the time of the upgrade, and there was one crossbuck installed.
Now, all of this...
There needed to be three.
All of this that you're addressing focuses on one different standard of proving liability, I assume, which I guess means the county and their requirements, and that they didn't meet them.
Well, federal preemption simply means that by complying with the federal regulations that are in effect at the time, as Shanklin says, the MUCTD specifications, the railroad can't be held liable under state tort law. Once they comply, once they install approved warning devices that are operational, then they're off the hook, regardless of whether or not under state tort law they should have done more, as they should have in this case.
The reason I asked, I have something that, it wasn't really argued, but it confused me a little bit, and that is her testimony. Now, there's some question about whether she was capable of testifying.
Yes, sir.
If her testimony is, we'll say, admissible or used, she pretty much says in her deposition she slid into that intersection.
Well,
and that would mean, I don't care what standard you're using, if she put on the brakes and it skidded in, she knew to stop and everything, and the train got in front of the train and hit her, all this other stuff is irrelevant. And if it's not used, you say it can't be used, then I don't see how she can prove her case. Therefore, if it's used, she loses. If it's not used, she can't win.
May I point out respectfully, Your Honor, why that is not necessarily correct?
Okay.
First of all, the kind of protection that this crossing needed was flashing lights and gates. Flashing lights and gates warn the motorist not that there's a crossing there, which she knew or she claims she knows, but that a train is approaching on the crossing. A train is imminent. It will soon be at the intersection. Vastly different. Allows the driver to react, slow down, stop, and so forth. Whereas with crossbucks, it's up to the motorist. It warns the motorist that there's a crossing there, but then it's up to the motorist to somehow discern the approach of a train. In this case, there were restricted sight lines that didn't allow her to make that judgment.
Well,
it would allow a reasonable judgment.
These questions go to causation, of course, but there's a... I thought that this was in the middle of January and there was no vegetation.
It was the middle of January. There was thick brush, but the predicate question here is not proximate cause. The predicate question is preemption, because if preemption does not apply, then the railroad should and could have put flashing lights and gates there and been held accountable for not doing that, which would have given her far more advance warning of the approach of a train, not just that a crossing's there. So the question is, does preemption apply? The answer to that question is no, and the reason is simple. The railroad did not comply with the MUCTD when it installed the protection, or allegedly installed the protection, back when this project was undertaken, this upgrade was undertaken. They had to do that. You see, if they do that, then the federal law governs, and the federal law says that's all they must do. But since they didn't do that, they're not entitled to preemption. And having not met that threshold showing that they are entitled to preemption, a showing that they must make because it is an affirmative defense, then it becomes a matter of state law whether or not the railroad acted reasonably given this ultra-hazardous crossing with restricted sight lines and so forth.
But to engage in that analysis, don't we have to go behind the federal approval, which we're required to accept under the Shanklin case?
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. There are, as I say, three real issues here. First, whether because Shanklin requires, and all of its precedent, requires that the devices be installed and operating and federally approved. They were not installed because they installed only two. The MUCTD required three crossbucks, two facing the direction from which Ms. Bouchard came. So the prerequisite showing can't be made that they were installed. The question is whether they were operating at the time even, because one of the crossbucks was never replaced, the one on the other side. And the testimony is that the reflectivity of this crossbuck wears out over a period of 6-7 years. No proof has ever been established that it was operating. And there's a case in the Eighth Circuit, Camille, which is still good law for the proposition that a crossbuck, to be considered operating, has to have adequate reflectivity. But they weren't operating.
If it's a nighttime accident, when reflectivity matters.
No, we're talking right now, Your Honor, about whether they met the threshold to allow them to invoke the preemption doctrine. You see, they can't wear the mantle of preemption unless they have shown these things to be true. Having not met that threshold, the preemption doesn't apply. And then whether it's daytime or nighttime is irrelevant because they had to comply with the MUCTD at the time this project was completed. And the MUCTD required highly reflectorized material on the crossbucks, required two crossbucks facing the direction from which Ms. Bouchard came.
Right. And my point is, though, to get into all of those questions requires us to go behind the federal government's sign-off that this project was completed. And the Shanklin case says it doesn't matter what happened afterwards, whether the signs deteriorated, whether, you know, something intervened to cause these warning signs not to be operable. If they're installed pursuant to the federal regulations and pursuant to the use of federal money, and the federal government signs off on that after it's done, then that's the end of it.
But that's the if they're installed pursuant to the federal regulations.
But once the federal government says yes, answers that question yes, and signs off on it as an approved project, then courts don't go behind that.
Well, I respectfully disagree, but let me point out another angle, and that is this. The testimony of the state agent, who is a federal agent in these instances for approval, and first of all, this crossing itself was never inspected after the upgrade. But
Shanklin also speaks to
that
you don't go to a crossing-by-crossing analysis.
But he said, absent a mistake, no approval would have been made of this non-compliant protection at a crossing, That's at the appendix 221. So he's saying, absent a mistake, they would have made this approval. Based on the factual predicates that we know to be true here, that they've only installed one and not three, or at least two facing the direction that Ms. Bouchard came from, we don't even know whether the reflectivity on the other side was adequate, this would not have been compliant. So to imbue the defendants from immunity, from state tort liability based upon a mistake, not only elevates form over substance, but it flies in the face of the Federal Railroad Safety Act's safety purpose.
Can you tell me how many other railroads use this crossing?
I'm sorry?
Were there other railroads that use this crossing?
Amtrak used, pursuant to an agreement, the CSX crossing, and that's the extent of the shared use that I'm aware of. I would like to reserve the balance of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Abramson?
A couple of comments that counsel made with regard to Shanklin are incorrect. Counsel indicated that there was a dispute in Shanklin as to whether or not federal funds were used. That was not disputed. The dispute in Shanklin is whether or not the installation of reflectorized crosswalks, which was approved, final acceptance by the Federal Highway Administration, just as it was in this case, were adequate. And there was a claim that there should have been flashers and gates. There was also a claim that there should have been a stop bar. And the Supreme Court said, once the federal government signs off, we don't go behind it. That's it. And that's exactly what we have in this case. There was no issue in Shanklin as to whether or not federal funds were used.
If preemption were originally established, would there be over time, would it be possible for that preemptive, I guess you'd call it protection, to dissipate where they would fall below certain standards?
Not under the holding in Shanklin. Shanklin says that once federal preemption attaches, that it's there. Whether the crosswalk, as counsel argues, in 25 years lost its reflectivity, or if 2 days after it was installed, it was knocked down by a vehicle. Shanklin says once federal preemption attaches, that's it. Now, Your Honor, another comment that counsel made was that the kind of protection we need here is flashers and gates. Well, the very essence of the federal preemption holding in Shanklin is that once the federal government, the Federal Highway Administration, approves the project, the argument that there should have been other or different type of traffic control devices or protection or crossing protection, whatever you want to call it, is no longer an issue in the case. And that's exactly what we have here. Counsel has said that the crossbuck or crossbucks that were installed at this crossing were not in compliance with the MUTCD. There is no evidence whatsoever in this record that that is so. Counsel's argument that under the manual, that under certain circumstances, double-faced flashers are required, there is no evidence whatsoever in this record that such a requirement was present in this case. There is no evidence whatsoever concerning any type of a engineering study at this crossing indicating that because of various factors that there should have been double-faced flashers. None whatsoever. Now, counsel took the deposition of Steve Hall, and Steve Hall is the custodian of the record, so to speak, and signed the declaration saying this is what the records show. He did not purport to have any personal knowledge of the project or this crossing. He said, I got a call or a subpoena, here's the records, It shows that on such and such a date, crossbucks were installed, highly reflectorized, that there were 750, approximately give or take, crossings of the predecessor of the CSXD, the LNN, and each one of those crossings, each one of those crossings was inspected by a representative of the Indiana Department of Highways, the predecessor to the Indiana Department of Transportation. The Federal Highway Administration then came in after we inspected them, and they spot-checked them, and they signed off and said they are in compliance. That's what happened in that case. Now, with regard to Cheryl Bouchard, her testimony, as Judge Mannion pointed out, she said she was completely familiar with the crossing. She was taking her daughter to a daycare, and depending on whether she was going to go to a particular convenience store to get her daughter a snack, which she was that day, she would take this route. If she was not going to get her daughter a snack, she would take a different route. And her practice was, as she approached the crossing, to come to a complete stop and to stop at a place where she could look both ways down the track and ascertain that it was clear there was no train coming. That day, she put her foot on the brakes, and the car didn't stop. And we asked her, why did the car not stop? She said, I don't know. It just didn't stop. And I didn't stop until I got on the tracks. I put my foot on the brakes, and the car didn't stop. So what we did was we filed a summary judgment motion on behalf of the railroad, CSXT, which owns the tracks, Amtrak, which was operating on the tracks. Judge Sykes, you asked, there are two railroads that use these tracks, CSX for some freight. I think there's maybe one or two freight trains a day and one or two Amtrak trains a day on these tracks. There are no other railroads that use these tracks.
Well, I assume it was icy that day because she said...
I'm sorry.
I assume it was icy or something because she said, my car stopped, I slid, my car stopped on the track. Now, I assume it slid.
We asked her that further, and I probably should have her deposition handy, and I don't have it right now. But she, when we tried to ask her what caused you to slide, she said, I don't know, I just slid. So if she slid because the road was icy, is the railroad responsible for that? We think not. And as Judge Mannion pointed out, when in a response to our summary judgment, the plaintiff said, Judge, don't consider that testimony because this lady had brain damage and she really doesn't know what happened and she's not competent to testify. That was when we filed the motion and said, now, wait a minute, we can't have it both ways. And Judge Sharp ordered a briefing. In the meantime, the summary judgment motions, the briefing was completed, the motions were argued, and we entered into this agreement where what was not a final judgment, there were still other claims of negligence against the railroad, not against the county. The county got a summary judgment on all issues. The railroad's got a summary judgment only on one issue. The judge denied our summary judgment on proximate cause. There were still allegations concerning the negligent training of the crew, negligent operation of the train, questions of vegetation, and in order to have a final appealable order, the plaintiff decided to forego all those other claims and said we're going to sink or swim on the federal preemption issue, and every point that's been raised by the appellant in this case has been ruled adversely against that claim by Shanklin. And for that reason, we believe that the judgment should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Lazarus, are you doing a rebuttal? Is that correct? Or Mr. Allen, how are you arranging your time?
Your Honor, I believe that there's another defendant.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Mr. Swan, didn't mean to leave you out. What time does he have?
7:30.
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Long. Go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel. The county defendants in this case, Newton County and Newton County Highway Department, defenses are lack of proximate cause and federal preemption. And just to clear something up, on page 279 of the appendix, which is page 24 of Cheryl Bouchard's brief, It says, I tried to stop, but the car slid. I don't know why it slid. I'm not sure if it was due to the condition of the highway. Just to clear that up. That was her testimony. But the allegations against Newton County are the fact that the signs were not proper, the line of sight was not proper, and the pavement markings were not proper. But if you look at Mrs. Bouchard's testimony, none of this had anything to do with the accident. She testified that she had traveled this road southbound on County Road 400 East about once a week for 2.5 years. Every time, religiously, she stopped at the stop or at the crossing because she knew that it might be dangerous. And the angle that she was approaching was not 90 degrees. If you look at the reports...
We have the police report.
Okay. Her view was greater than 90 degrees. The documents indicate that the short angle was from 30 to 60, so she would have from 120 to 150 degrees of visibility of the oncoming train that hit her car. And if you look at the photographs at pages 106, 107, and 108 in the appendix, you will see that in this January accident, the field of vision was clear all the way down to the grain mill, and there was no obstruction to vision. And Mrs. Bouchard even testified that if she had stopped, as she always did for the last 2.5 years, her line of sight was not blocked. She could have seen the approaching train. That's her testimony. So whether there was a stop sign there or the pavement markings, she knew that it was a crossing. This is what she did all the time and had nothing to do with her accident. Her testimony is that she slid, and that's why she had the accident. And there's no allegations against Newton County about the sliding. She didn't know why she slid. So from the county's point of view, the line of sight, the markings, anything like that is a red herring because that did not cause her accident. The preemption, we have argued, and Judge Sharp agreed, does apply to Newton County in this situation. And I found it interesting. We looked and looked and looked. And we could not find anything in this circuit, anything in the state of Indiana that says yes or no, that the state or a government entity is covered by the federal preemption. And we had to go to Minnesota to find the Hernandez case to say that the state and the state governments is covered by this preemption. But it makes sense, and Judge Sharp made that one step further in his granting of summary judgment in this case. I would also point out that when we look at federal preemption, it's interesting that the Cochran case that's cited in our brief came from also the Northern District of Indiana, deals with the exact same crossing on the exact same issue. Somebody was hit by the train at that crossing, and the federal magistrate in the Cochran case found that all of the criteria were met, that federal preemption applied, and that whatever complaints you have now about that crossing are out the window because of Shanklin. And that's what the situation is here. There's no difference. What happened in 1975 and 1976 when all this railroad grade crossing was upgrading was being done was by the book and approved. And as Mr. Abrahamson pointed out, on page 77 of the appendix, the federal government says that the Department of Highways inspected every crossing on this Louisville and Nashville line. And that was the train that had the line at that time. So it meets the criteria, according to Shanklin. You can't cry now if the milk is spilt.
So preemption in this context really functions more like immunity. It doesn't substitute litigation under the federal standard for litigation under the state standard. It just provides a form of immunity. Is that fair to say?
I guess you could look at it that way, but the federal preemption is to the state is, should there have been a stop sign put up? Should there be this new thing put up? Should there be the lights and the bells and the whistles and all that sort of thing? Is protected because the decision was made back in the 70s as to what was necessary at this crossing. The discretionary immunity, we argued, applied to the putting of the stop sign at the crossing. And the Shanklin says that, no, if this is the case in 1976, that doesn't mean it's the case in 2076. You can always go back and look at these crossings and reassess it. Are there different traffic patterns and that sort of thing to see if upgrades are needed. But it's not mandated, and until it's determined that those upgrades are needed, the standard is back when it was approved in the 1970s, 1980s.
That Cochran case you referred to.
Yes, sir.
Did you cite that in your brief? I'm looking for it in the authorities. I don't see it. Anyway, you said it was with regard to the same intersection, and it already went through the analysis of preemption. Is that correct?
Yes, and I apologize. It was not in the brief.
Well, then we should have, since you cited it, we should have supplemental authority, so you should serve the parties and the court with a citation to that case. Then.
It is in the judge's
That's fine, but you
memorandum and order.
Okay, you send the supplemental authority, if you would. Thank you.
Court, have any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, now is it...
The appellees have 30 seconds left.
I don't think you have 30 seconds left. You don't have a rebuttal, if that's what you want to do.
I'm just going to say Cochran is an archery. It's not the same crossing. It's the same line.
Oh, all right. Well, that I guess that's...
34 of archery.
All right. That's all we'll need then. Thanks. I guess you're Mr. Lazarus?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks. Sorry for calling you too early.
May it please the court, I'm William Lazarus, another attorney for the appellants in this case. There have been some questions about causation. Let me just say that's not really the key to this appeal, but had our client been aware and been warned adequately, she would have started and realized the danger of that train coming. She would have started to brake earlier and wouldn't have slipped right at the end. But I don't want to dwell on that, because the issue here is not causation. It's a question of whether preemption prevents any trial court consideration of causation. And I think that the Shanklin case does not stand for what the Railroad Council says. The Shanklin case never considered the issue of whether the fundamental requirements for crossbucks provided by the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, this MUTCD, it never considered whether those crossbucks met the standards, because it said very clearly and plainly in the decision that it was agreed that the newly installed crossbucks were fully compliant with the federal standards. So the whole issue of, gee, should we be reviewing the Federal Highway Administration's decision as to these standards, whether they were complied or not, drops out. The court never really considered that in Shanklin. What the court was considering was whether there had to be a separate individualized study of individualized crossings to determine whether flashing lights and automatic gates had to be installed. And the court said no. But at the same time, the court emphasized that the regulations were not simply a matter of definitions. It wasn't simply regulations without teeth. And that's the critical issue. And if the regulations have some teeth, if they have some meaning, then the court, then in this case, for instance, we're saying the regulations, the fundamental MUTCD regulations, weren't complied with. And I think both Easterwood and Shanklin referred to those fundamental regulations as not even coming under the doctrine of preemption. So we're saying that the question here is one that comes before all the questions of proximate cause and who knew what and how the accident happened. It's really the fundamental issue of whether you can have state regulations that have no teeth or that they have no court possibility of even court review bouncing federal regulations, bouncing the state tort law, and have nothing basically in their place. And that simply does not make sense. Look at Easterwood, which the Shanklin Court adopted.
Counsel, you're arguing Justice Ginsburg's dissent in Shanklin, which obviously didn't carry the day.
But there is a long tradition.
That's precisely what she argued.
There is a long tradition of looking to the core of a case and the decision and what the decision rested on versus the dicta in a case. And the core of the case in Shanklin regarded this advanced warning system and individualized studies, and the court specifically noted that the installed devices were fully compliant with federal law. So, and they also, the court also stated that the regulations have meaning. They're not merely definitional. So granted, there's language that goes both ways in Shanklin, but I think you need to look to the core of the case and look to Easterwood too, which Shanklin didn't reject. And Easterwood said, gee, the money was spent, the devices were installed, but they were the wrong devices. Well, if there was no basis for reviewing that, for looking at the regulations, say, well, what do the regulations provide, and what was put in? How could the court even say they're the wrong devices? This is an issue of preemption. It's before this court. It's a fundamental issue, and there ought to be court review of this matter and minimum standards in order to replace state standards. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks to all counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.